The Guardian.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
You've been with another man, haven't you?
Today, top four in Champions League. Crouchy Tiger hidden penalties. Man United gets stuck in Stoke. Will they boom in brush with Basel? A test for Man City in Munich. Can the club that can't stop buying players stop buying players? Chelsea travel to the heart of the matter. His old club Valencia. And Arsenal take on the most successful club in Greek history. And they've got a fair bit of that over there. Elsewhere, Sid in Spain, Horncastle in the pod, Rafa on the blur and Duache on another planet as we round up all the other talking points in this crazy old game. And get your posts and tweets in today's Football Weekly. Here we are then. Yes, back in a barely recognisable world where Owen Hargreaves still score goals, where Fernando Torres still scores goals, and people don't know the name Giampiero Gasperini. I feel a bit like Charlton Heston in that film with the monkeys. Barry Glendinning, lovely to see you, though, sticking out the sand like the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, delighted, delighted you're back. I know we saw another man, but it meant nothing, and we thought of you all the time.
Right, yeah. I saw plenty of other men, actually.
Yeah, big, burly men with huge...
Satisfyingly so.
Steroid-enhanced muscles.
Well, I don't know what you mean by that, Barry. I don't know what you mean at all. Lovely to see you, though. James Horncastle, thanks ever so much for dropping in.
It's very good to be here.
Great news.
I'm hairy like an ape.
Excellent. And also, from the land of the cerebrum, it's Fernando Duache. Hi, Fernando.
Hi, guys.
Yeah, very, very kind of you to join us. You were due in some weeks ago, but the little girl wasn't well, was she?
She had a bit of a complication, but everything is fine now.
Cool.
I would like to publicly thank the NHS for doing well. You know, sometimes they get a bad rep, but, you know.
They sorted out Fernando Duache.
Yeah, Royal Alexander Hospital in Brighton. Mwah! Big kiss for you guys.
All right, well, I know they're big listeners, so just keep doing the good stuff down there. Now, interesting weekend, eh?
Was it?
Yeah.
I beg to differ.
All right, then.
It was a terrible weekend.
I mean, for me, everything, I returned to this landscape that has been turned upside down. But
changed utterly.
Man United dropping points, eh?
I thought it was great, you know, to see somebody giving them a game. Because the start of the season was pretty much like, they're going to run away with that. And there's a whole thing that Manchester is the capital of the world or the English football. Now, it's interesting to see that some guys are going to put up a fight. I still think that the title is pretty much going to be decided between them two, unless Chelsea saw themselves out.
Was this game an indication of trouble ahead for Man United with Rooney out, the fact that they were less effective? Or was it simply the fact that without one of the best players in the league and with a penalty that should have been given to them instead not being given and them losing another of their finest strikers at the same time, any club would have suffered?
Yeah, perhaps two penalties because Hernandez was pushed by Woodgate into Begovic and then Evra's shot hit, was it Shawcross's arm in the box? So Pulis did admit that his side were fortunate, A, because Rooney was injured. Hernandez then came in and was hurt early on. Johnny Evans was injured in a warm-up, so they had to bring Valencia in at right-back, who I think is their sixth different right-back in 26 games.
Mm-hmm.
They had to play the expensive boy from Blackburn as centre-back. What is his name?
Phil Jones.
Yeah, and he was massive, wasn't it?
Well, massive, yeah. Mr. November says, I have a couple of points about Phil Jones and De Gea. There's been massive acclaim for Jones because of his barnstorming runs, but his defensive positioning is often suspect. Crouch, who moves like a horse falling downstairs, did very little and still managed to outjump him for the goal and completely lose him in the six-yard box, so he's less convinced about Jones. And De Gea says he looks like he may be destined to become the new Shea Given, a brilliant shot-stopper, but one who never commands his area and affects the whole bat line as a result. Is he a brilliant shot-stopper, though?
Well, he saved two brilliant shots on Saturday, and he's had more shots fired at him than any other goalkeeper in the Premier League and has stopped most, if not all of them. So, yeah, he probably is very good. I mean, two of his saves on Saturday were sensational. But Stoke obviously targeted his weakness in the air and stationed a man on him for all corners. Like Rory Delap was put standing right in front of him. And he was at fault for the goal. He was rooted to his line, but I think Ferguson has said in a press conference that a lot of people really seem to want De Gea to fail. And I think he has a point, but I've been very impressed with him. He's not perfect by any means, but he's just a kid and he's very, very good. I think the fact he's quite thin and doesn't seem to fill the shirt very well He kind of looks like a bit of a schoolboy there with the shirt hanging out over his shorts. It's very baggy. And that perhaps doesn't go in his favour either. He looks like someone who's just wandered in off the street to play in goal for United.
Van der Sar was a bit of a thin, Ricky.
Yeah, and people forget that Van der Sar had a horrible 2008-2009 season. You know, remember when he and Ferdinand was like, they were like Keystone Coppers just bumping into each other. And United considered like a lot of goals because of defensive errors. It's not a very nice position to be. It's always difficult. The Premier League is quite physical in the keepers. And if you look at the stats between Italy, for example, James Horncastle, not James Richardson.
No, clearly not.
Yeah. If you look
come to this, listen.
Above statistics in terms of, I mean, how many times the keeper is involved in actions, in known, you know, shot stopping actions. In England, I think it's twice or three times more than Italy, according to a study I read a couple of weeks ago. It's quite interesting.
No, it certainly is.
Anyone should come into the studio pulling an airplane with their teeth, we'll ask for your opinion.
All right, then. Excellent. Man United will be hosting Basel, who are the fourth best team in Switzerland. Woof. All right, then.
They have Thorsten Frink, who obviously was on the Bayern Munich side when they lost to United in 1999.
Right, so revenge, you think?
Exactly.
Exactly.
They've got some good players. Their goalkeeper, I think he's called Jan Sommer, who's very young, talented.
Does he fill his shirt?
I suspect he doesn't.
Okay. All right. Listen, I'm going to move on to Man City. I had a bit of a struggle against Everton, didn't they, before the brilliance of David Silva saw them through. My word, what an extraordinary little bit of play that was before his wondrous assist.
Well, he does have an unfair advantage over the rest of the players because Jamie Redknapp mentioned how he literally floats around the field, possibly through the use of levitation, or perhaps he is one of those Back to the Future hoverboards. But obviously it's going to be easier for him. I was just having a look today.
You might have a helium-filled shirt.
Yeah.
Come on, what's a nice metaphor? You guys got to
Exactly.
Jamie
a sums
leg sometimes.
It's
not
really
always
simple,
dull.
Fernando. The word is literally. Yeah. The word is literally. Just don't use the word literally.
But he has a fine collection. I was looking him up today.
So put Alan Shearer there. Let's all watch Alan Shearer and Alan Hansen and all fall asleep. You know, collective. Sleepiness and torpor, because you know you got to commentate at least twice.
Who's your dream pundit lineup then, Fernando?
Real lineup. Oh, Jesus Christ, it's difficult in England.
He would be good.
So
yeah.
We agree. You know that there's a story, a fantastic story, that Jesus and Moses.
Okay.
And in this kickabout pitch in Brazil by the sea, and Christ tells Moses, "Listen, I want to try to score the goal that Pele couldn't score. You know, the one that he hits from midfield." And basically loves a kipper. There's no kipper, but I'm going to try to hit the top of the top L from here.
Oh, okay.
And Moses says, "Listen, Pelé didn't do it, so how the hell are you going to do it?" No, just roll the ball. Okay, Moses rolled and Christ whacks it and far away in the water. He asks Moses to go there. Moses opens up the waters of the Guanabara Bay, picks up the ball. "So can we just keep on playing?" No, I'm going to try once more. And once again, he hoofs it to the sea. And Moses says, "Now you go. And you pick up the ball this time," and Christ obviously walks on water. Then some guys are arriving for the kickabout and they say, "What the hell is that guy doing? Does he think he's Jesus Christ?" And Moses, "No, he thinks it's Pele."
Anyway, saying, other examples of Jamie misusing the word literally, he was talking about balls literally exploding off your feet. Alonso and Sissoko picked to literally sit in front of the back four. Ben Haim being literally left for dead. Some player or other literally turning into a greyhound, which I'd like to have seen. Michael Chopra literally making time stand still. Lionel Messi literally sending people out of the stadium with his skill. Some player literally not having a right foot. And Wayne Rooney literally having the ball served to him on a plate.
Sure, the producer at Sky, they have got a dictionary somewhere.
What?
Where did you get these from?
It's just a collection of his best, greatest hits from some website or other.
I have to say, I now agree with you, Fernando. Much better to have that.
Much better to have that.
Yeah. So that's fantastic. Where were we talking about? Oh, yeah, David Silva's great, and he floats, and Balotelli scored, and then he gave Mancini a big hug, which is nice. But his goal was a bit jammy because it went off somebody else. And he's suspended anyway for this trip to Bayern Munich, which is an absolutely massive trip because Bayern Munich are only off to their best ever start ever in their history.
9 consecutive wins, 9 consecutive clean sheets.
Yeah, in all competitions. Sounds like a good time to call up Raphael Honigstein. Raphael Honigstein, are you there?
I am, hello.
Hi, Raphael. Now, you're not in Munich yet, but that's where you're heading, yes?
I am indeed, yes.
Is this the best Bayern team you've ever seen?
Not sure. I think it's a bit too early to say that. Bayern has started tremendously well in the league, winning 6 out of 7 without conceding a goal. In the Champions League, they're looking good. But I think City is the one game that everyone's waiting for to just measure how good Bayern are, because I think at the moment there's still a slight suspicion that they're just an enormously big fish, but in a fairly small pond. So I think with City, we'll finally have some sort of more objective measure to just how good this team is.
All right. Well, they literally blew Villarreal away in the first Champions League clash. Did they watch Everton's game against Man City and note the efficiency with which Rodwell was able to hold Silva down for 60 minutes or so? Not literally, I'd say, but still. Reduces effectiveness.
They might have, but I think man marking, as Roberto Mancini said, has not been very popular for the last 20 years, and I don't think Bayern will resort to these tactics. If anything, it's interesting because both teams, of course, have mostly played against opponents who defend it very deep in their games, and now they've come up against a team who is best going forward. I think without De Jong, City can almost play only one way, much more attacking than last year. And the same is true of Bayern, although, of course, they have this fantastic balance this year, which has enabled them to keep 9 clean sheets.
Mm. Yeah, they're much better defensively. What about this this fellow Breno, though? An extraordinary story currently there in Germany. The Bayern Munich defender who's... Has he been arrested for unsuspected arson of his own house?
Yes, he has. It's a very odd story and slightly sad as well. On Tuesday night, he effectively burned down his rented villa in Grünwald. There was no casualties, no damage to any property apart from the sad villa, and no people were hurt. So it wasn't as bad as it could have been, but he was arrested. The police are suspecting his involvement. It seems that he suffered from all sorts of problems, one of which was a recurring knee problem, which might need further surgery. And here's just someone who's probably kind of just lost his way a little bit. And Bayern, I think, have tried to dress this all up or to disguise the fact that they perhaps should have taken more care of their player by having a right go at the public prosecutor, saying, you know, how can they lock up such a nice young man who just, you know, needed a bit of a pat on the shoulder. But it hasn't been very convincing.
Rafa, it's Fernando here. There are a lot of reports that Bayern was actually trying to get him into proper counselling in a way that even people in Brazil have been talking to Breno might have lost his mind a bit. We're talking about a player who left Brazil at 18, having won the silver ball and being this amazing promise of a fantastic defender for the future. And all of a sudden, you know, he might be locked up for arson.
Yeah, well, you're right. I mean, they did try. They sent him to the institute that was treating Sebastian Deisler with his depression problems. Breno went to one session, then didn't go again. Jo Pinkus, who talked to him in Portuguese, said he wasn't really aware of the extent of any problems because he was sort of doing his normal rehabilitation program without any problems. But I do think that they perhaps neglected him somewhat. As you said, he came over to Munich very, very young, was never really in the team. I had a good spell at Nuremberg on loan, but then got injured again. He's been very, very unlucky and perhaps a little bit lonely as well. And this is just the latest episode, but you just hope that it'll have some sort of positive outcome at the other side.
Rafa, just before we leave you then, enjoy the trip, but a quick prediction for the game?
I don't do predictions.
You do predictions. They just don't go very well for you.
Exactly, that's why I stopped. Okay. Can we end on something?
No, all right. Okay.
I have something we can end in. There are pictures in the papers over here today, Rafa, of Didier Drogba in lederhosen at the Oktoberfest, ooh, having a grand old time, and he's shaking hands with and chatting with his old mucker, Mad Jens Lehmann.
Well, that's the effect 3 or 4 litres of beer can have on you. You know, you make peace with your enemies and
you make peace in all sorts of ways.
You're my best mate.
Wear ridiculous trousers. Right. Yeah.
Will you be doing that yourself this week?
I'm definitely hoping to do that this
all
week.
Right.
Yeah. Raphael, Lederhosen was an optional though.
Enjoy the trip there, eh?
Thank you.
All right. Well, it sounds like this Breno chap is someone whose home form is quite literally on fire. Then we can
you know, after Hafa has the care of saying how delicate the situation of the guy is, and you correct his horrendous joke, James.
It's not a joke, it's true. Jesus. But anyway, speaking of arson, how about Wenger's Arsenal, eh? They're they're fresh from a 3-0 win over Bolton. Hey, Van Persie, that's 100 goals now. Don't know if you saw this. He's scored 21 in 23 games. He's doing brilliantly. And is he going to leave now, Barry?
Looks like it.
Him and Thomas Vermaelen as well.
Yes, well, I hadn't heard about Vermaelen.
Well, apparently he's in the same contractual time frame.
And limbo.
And isn't in a hurry to renew the deal. But I don't know. And certainly Van Persie's the one they're all talking about. For the moment, he's looking great. And Chesney's looking great. He's got a while before the deal actually ends. It's not the end of this season. It's 2013. So, you know, I think this is a little bit alarmist, isn't it?
Well, obviously he could go for nothing then. So if they wanted to make a few quid on him, they'd have to get rid of him this summer, wouldn't they?
Well, a 3-0 win anyway for Arsenal, which may or may not spell them turning a corner in their troubled season so far. But it certainly does leave Bolton in all sorts of trouble. They're down at the bottom of the table. They've lost 5 in a row. The last time they were this bad was when Sammy Lee was in charge, just to put things in perspective.
When they were that low.
Yeah. And, I don't know. Is it just a result of the difficult early season fixtures that they had because they played all the big teams? Or is this going to be the season when it all catches up with them?
Kevin Davis was dropped this weekend.
Mm. Was he?
For the first time in a very, very long time. I think he came on as a sub and possibly should have been sent off then. So, he's not having a very good time. But he's only scored, I think, 4 goals in the last very long time.
And a sign of things is that they used to beat Arsenal all the time. Remember, Bolton always taking points of Arsenal. Now they can even do it.
Oh, Chesney was brilliant, though.
Chesney was good, wasn't he?
Saved from Prattley and Eagles to just keep it in the balance, keep nerves settled for once.
Part 2. Chelsea, Andre Villas-Boas, beginning to see his seeds blossoming into green shoots and stuff. 4-1, despite being a man down, against plucky Welsh side Swansea. Hmm? What do you want to talk about? Fernando Torres?
Well, he's...
Lampard? What is it? Come on.
Well, there was a suggestion Lampard threw a bit of a hissy fit when he wasn't used as a substitute and stomped off down the tunnel. Now, I didn't see this, so I don't know if it's true. He did leave the bench early and go down the tunnel, whether he stomped, strolled, ran, huffed and puffed.
However
I don't
he left,
know.
It's not a good sign, I have to say.
Well, I think some of those reports have been denied. But again, he was overlooked because I think Villas-Boas took off Morelles and brought on Josh McEachran. I'm quite keen to see how Morelles has been doing because a lot of his passing is much more direct than Lampard. He seems to get the ball to the front line a lot quicker, whereas I think Lampard kind of just carries the ball forward, then shifts it to one side. I think all during pre-season, Villas-Boas was talking about transitions, how that's so important to his game, how important it is to circulate the ball from front to back really quickly. I think Morelles is probably the better architect for that than Lampard.
Right, and Ramirez looks a more effective goal-scoring midfielder as well now.
Yeah, I thought against Manchester United he had a very good game, although he missed a sitter which put on a plate for him by Torres, and then Torres created a goal for him at the weekend. He got two.
I tweeted the other day that Torres, Chelsea's career, was one of the biggest or the most expensive comedy movies of all time at £50 million, but You look at the United. In fairness, at the United game, he was much better than I've seen him since he moved in, and he had a great game until that stupid tackle. But then again, he's a striker; he shouldn't be tackling there. I'm really glad he doesn't know how to tackle, the opposition, because otherwise, some stupid coach might make him play as a midfielder or something like that. He was having a great game, and the pass for Ramirez is sweet, the whole movement,
All right, now another midfielder at Chelsea in fine fettle is Juan Mata, who this midweek, will be heading back to his old club, Valencia. Perennial furnishers of fine Spanish talent, like Villa Silva, have emerged from their ranks. How are they doing now? Let's dial up Sid Lowe and hear what kind of opposition they're going to afford Chelsea.
Hello, James. How are you?
I'm very well. You're in your front room, aren't you?
No, I'm not in my front room, no.
Which room are you in?
What makes you think that? I'm not in any room. I'm in the, I don't know what you'd call this. I'm in the foyer. I'm just walking outside now into the sunshine.
All right. Lovely.
I'm in the foyer at the Raya Vallecano training ground.
Ah, great. And what are you doing there?
Hopefully talking to the former Liverpool player Danny Pacheco.
Ah, right. OK. And, of course, they were at the heart of a massive game this weekend as Real bounced back from their recent misery with a whopping 6-2 win.
Yeah, a whopping 6-2 win. But the most amazing thing about it, given the context, because, of course, Madrid went into the game having drawn and lost their last two, lots of talk about players not being happy with Mourinho. For the first time, even the Madrid media was starting to really, really kind of say that this isn't working, something's wrong. And after 12 seconds, Rayo Vallecano were winning 1-0. Mm-hmm. And it really did feel like, wow, this is going to blow up. But Real Madrid have that astonishing ability to score goals, particularly when they're given a lot of space in front of them, which Rayo did. And it finished 6-2 with Cristiano Ronaldo getting another hat-trick.
How many has he got this season?
You know what, off the top of my head, I think that makes it 7.
All right. And Messi, meanwhile, Messi's had 9 games, 12 goals and 10 assists.
It's absolutely ridiculous. And this is the thing, I know I've said this before, so apologies for saying the same thing again, but I think what makes Messi so unbelievable is that he's turned really extraordinary things into something routine. It's that he does this almost every single week now. Another hat-trick for him against Atletico Madrid. All 3 goals were brilliant in slightly different ways. It's just astonishing. It really is.
All right, then.
And see who plays Stoke. I'm not convinced.
Yeah.
I'm not convinced.
Absolutely, until he plays Stoke, no one's convinced. I mean, if Man United couldn't beat them on a Saturday, what chance have Barcelona got on a Wednesday?
Right, indeed so. Now, Messi's going to be at... They're at Bati Borisov.
Yes.
Yes.
The Tractor and Park Company team.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Is that a game they're very concerned about in the Catalan sort of... semi-republic?
Well, a little bit, because obviously they only drew their first game at home, so I think they're aware of the need to pick up points and pick them up quickly to make absolutely certain that they're not in a position where... I mean, they won't be in a position where they don't come through the group, but they could put themselves in a position where they don't win the group, which, of course, has a knock-on effect in the next round. So actually, I think they are a little bit more concerned about this than you might expect, because they anticipate AC Milan picking up a lot of points in the other games, and therefore they need to make sure they don't drop any. And also bear in mind that actually Barcelona's away record in the Champions League is really pretty poor.
Yeah, I remember them going to... Where was it? It wasn't Bati, but it was a similar side. Who was it?
Wasn't that...
Well, pretty much everywhere they've been. They've been to Shakhtar and there.
Oh, yeah, Rubin Kazan, yeah.
Yeah, they also lost to... Oh, what, the Ukrainian side, what's the name? Shakhtar.
They went to Shakhtar Donetsk. They were given a really tough time by Copenhagen last year as well. So it has been good for them on the road.
Oh. Finally, then, Sid, two teams beginning with V. Valencia, who are taking on Chelsea, and also wanted to know about Villarreal, who travelled to Napoli. How are those two teams looking as they go into these big European games?
Looked very, very good indeed against Barcelona in midweek. I think they're a very, very good side. They changed their formation completely, though, this weekend and rested one or two players, and it didn't work at all away in Seville. I still think that Valencia are a side who, when they pressure and when they play on the basis of what the other team's going to do and they react to it and they're defensively bright, I think they're a very, very good team indeed. I still think at times it's difficult for them to take the weight of the game and control the game and go for people. Against Chelsea, that may not be a problem. Villarreal, I think, are in trouble, to be honest with you. I think they look very slow. They look very flat. They haven't what they had last year. I think the departure of Santi Cazorla is a big, big blow for them. And I'm starting to be ever so slightly pessimistic about Villarreal's chances this year.
Sid Lowe there, quite literally in Spain.
There's something I need to tell you guys. Oh. I mean, later on for the pod, there's been reports on Saturday that Brazil and FIFA are in very, very bad terms.
About the World Cup?
Yeah, because of the law that gives the power to FIFA. So there's even talk that FIFA might pull a special clause and take the tournament away from Brazil.
Crikey. That's coming up in part three, listeners. Right. Okay, what were we just talking about? Oh, yeah, Villarreal playing Napoli, team from Serie A. Now, James, nobody watches Serie A anymore, I understand.
It's very uncompetitive.
I don't know if you've been ever... having a bit of a chuckle.
And clubs don't have any identities.
No identities. Yes. What I'm flummoxed about is how somebody on Sunday Supplement who begins the conversation with, do you watch Serie A? I didn't think anyone watches that anymore. Seriously, then proceeds to describe what clubs are like there. If you don't watch it, that's fine. That's your decision. But don't then opine on what's on national television.
It's quite
entire nation's football.
Because at this moment in time, Serie A is the most competitive it's ever been in terms of the start of the season. Because I think from first place, Juventus to Udinese to 16th place is only
5 points.
5 points.
And this comment was made for the benefit of our readers who may not know what the Sunday Supplement is. It's a sort of a 4 or 5 Fleet Street's finest sitting around a table with coffee and croissants discussing the football issues of the day. Not dissimilar to this podcast, really, except we don't have croissants or coffee. Sorted out, producer Ben. And one of them on Sunday said that nobody watches Serie A anymore. Club, and then they had a discussion about how Serie A clubs don't have any identity and how Serie A isn't competitive. Hmm. And this at the end of a week in which Inter were beaten by a team who haven't been in Serie A for about 400 years. And it was just remarkable.
Literally 400 years, yeah.
I mean, going back to club identity, I mean, did these people not see the footage from Juventus's new stadium opening where you have Andrea Agnelli, the president, the latest in a long line of that family who have been in control of that club since 1923, delivering one of the most sort of, you know, he asked the people in the audience to close their eyes, and then when they open them again, look around you, because those are the faces of Juventus. Incredibly sort of moving speech, sort of, you know, would you get a United chairman doing that? Would David Gill or Malcolm Glazer do something like that? Would
Delia Smith might.
Delia Smith, she would.
Nice to have you.
So,
but, identity. For goodness sake, there is no country with a stronger regional identity than Italy, and it is absolutely expressed through the clubs. That's half the problem half the time with the atmosphere at Serie A games, is that it is so heated. On the whole competitiveness thing, it's extraordinary. I mean, the top eight have 1 point separating them. And Gazzetta dello Sport actually today making the not irrelevant point that it was only last year that the new collective TV deal came really into action. It was passed in 2007. Previously, basically, the big three had divvied up the money between themselves, a bit like happens in some other countries. And now it's all on a collective deal. Obviously, there are some factors that weigh more heavily in the bigger clubs' favour. But they make the point that the difference between the highest paid club in terms of TV revenue, which is the biggest source of income in Italy, it's 60% of clubs' income, the highest earning from TV and the lowest earning from TV now have a ratio of 4-1, which sounds like quite a lot. Before this deal went through, it was 8-1. Currently in Spain, it's 16-1. So it's a massive factor in evening out the playing field.
Yeah, it's a lot more democratic in the sense that I think 40% of the money distributed is distributed equally. 30% is then results based, and then the remaining 30% is determined by how many supporters each of these clubs has, which created a bit of an argument at the beginning of the season. But in layman's terms, that means the smaller clubs have more money to spend. So you see, I think Milan was 7 million euros worse off than they were last season from the money they received in TV rights, whereas I think Chievo was 6 million better off, and Udinese were likewise 10 million better off. But
they lost a bit of ground. It is undeniable in terms of finance. If you look at how Serie A fell in the ranks of the big leagues, and obviously the amount of cash being poured in Spain and England attracted more talent. So instead of they concentrating everybody as in the 80s, they now have to be a bit more, you know, communist in a certain way. But I really think it's ludicrous when people try to bury Italian football, because every time they do it, something happens. Like in 2003, Serie A is dead, and then 3 out of the 4 Champions League semi-finalists were from Italy. So,
going back to sort of competition, a very petty point, but, a Serie A club has been Champions League winners more recently than an English club. Inter in 2010.
Yeah. And speaking of Inter, they finally won a game. Their first win of the season. Claudio Ranieri comes in. First game in charge. Bosh.
They did. They won 3-1 at Bologna. And it was quite interesting because his first press conference was, he was answering this sort of criticism that he is the anti-Inter, the anti-Mourinho, which he had been at Juventus and at Roma. And Mourinho was sort of even being asked about what he thought about Ranieri coming in. And he called him a pseudo-Interista. So, but he said at the same time that it doesn't matter as long as he wins. And Ranieri, to his credit, sort of responded to that saying, you know, I'm a very professional guy. You know, we were on opposite sides before. Now we're on the same side. And he kind of accepts his role now as a fixer, a normalizer. He said something like, I know my karma, and it's to be the ajustatore, the adjuster. And he came in, he adjusted things, retouched it. The four-man back line was restored. Cambiasso was played as a holding midfielder, and they had Forlan and Pazzini, the guy who was excluded, of course, under Gasperini, scoring the opening goal. So,
any idea why Gasperini excluded Pazzini?
I think it's... I'm not entirely sure. I mean, the one thing that Pazzini gives for your play is he's not particularly mobile, but you can ping the ball right up to him and he'll take it down, he'll hold it up, and the rest of the team will then move forward with him, which is something that wasn't happening under Gasperini.
All right, with Zerati, who was generally played in that role.
Yeah, terrible player.
the impressive thing as well about the game at Bologna is it was without Wesley Sneijder, who's also going to be injured for what looks like a tougher test for Inter this midweek against CSKA Moscow, who are currently second in the Russian league. All sorts of players are out for Inter, are they not? Forlan, of course, cup-tied because nobody bothered
Montari, who's coming to do a job in midfield, is cup-tied as well, but they're also without Sneijder, Motta,
Maicon.
So
Stankovic. Yeah. What do you think about that game then?
I think it's going to be a rude awakening because obviously he had 3 days to prepare for the Bologna game.
Yeah.
And that wasn't plain sailing. In the second half, they came under a lot of pressure. And Lucio, quite interesting, he's been the sort of weak link, although he scored the sort of winning header, I guess, in the 3-1 win. But I mean, it's a tale of both Milan clubs is that they've got serious injuries. Inter's are in midfield, and Milan's are in attack. With Ibrahimovic going to miss the Victoria Plzen match.
I thought they said maybe he would be back. He might got nobody else.
But they don't want to rush him back because Sunday's Juventus.
Yeah,
which is obviously their next big match and Juventus' first big match of the season. But Pato is out with his 12th injury in 2 years. They've ruled out sending him to America. Obviously, Inzaghi's cup tied. They've had to throw in Stephen Alshoary, the half Egyptian, half Italian guy who scored in midweek.
Also excited, so they've got there's available forwards for the game against the Plzen. They've got Cassano, the chubby fella, and the son of Maurizio Gantz.
Yeah.
How exciting is that? Do you remember Maurizio Gantz, Barry?
No.
Didn't you watch Serie A? That was back in the days when people actually watched Serie A. Mid-90s.
They used to talk about it on Sunday Supplement.
Yeah.
You had the Mizura thing and the little snake in the shirt.
No, it was just after those days. I think when he was... it was before Pirelli. Well, I don't know what sponsor they had. But anyway, Maurizio Gantz, I mean, he played for everybody, but he's a super player, really terrific player, who, you know, basically I don't think he ever got the acclaim he should have. But his son, he's only 42, but his son's 18. How does that work?
Gantz Jr.
He has a son when he's 24.
Yeah. That'll be it then. Yeah. Anyway, so his son is in the squad. Simone Gantz. Great. Terrific. But anyway, Milan, they should be all right against Victoria Plzen, shouldn't they?
Yeah. Yeah. They should do.
All right. Other things to mention briefly.
When did you break your duck, Jimbo? Just if you find the idea of a 24-year-old fathering a child so utterly implausible.
Is it 24? Is that 18 and 46? Yeah, it is. Okay. No, you're right.
Late bloomer, were
you? Oh, yeah. Very much so. Very much so. James, you got man love for Pablo Daniel Osvaldo, it says here.
Paul Daniel Oswald, as his name would be translated. He rivals Cavani in terms of just pure sex. Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I think he does. He wears a headband, and he celebrated. He scored the goal against Parma, which gave Luis Enrique and Roma their first win.
Yeah, also this weekend.
And he celebrated with the mitraglia, the machine gun.
Yeah.
Which for a guy with the surname, what was Paul Daniel Oswald, there was something Lee Harvey Oswald.
Right.
And then there was the. It was kind of inopportune as well because I think tragically three Italian soldiers were killed in Afghanistan last week.
Oh, right.
He celebrated.
Yeah, machine guns. I have to say, they're never my celebration.
Battistuta got in trouble for that, Fiorentina, remember?
Yeah. I don't know if he ever got in trouble, did he?
Yeah, there was this whole thing, let's try to make the game less violent, the ultras are going to fight because of the players. But Battistuta used to have this machine gun celebration as well, and people didn't like it. I found it a load of bullets.
Did he have it on automatic or semi-automatic?
I don't know. I didn't see him recharging. I don't know.
Yeah, really. I go automatically on that. But, as you say, first win for Luis Enrique. Roma didn't look that impressive. I have to say, Osvaldo, though, is a player they bought for... How much did they spend on him?
70 million.
And he scored about one... He was in Serie A before.
He's very famous for scoring a bicycle kick against Torino for
Fiorentina. That was about his only goal ever, but it was a great goal.
It got Fiorentina into the Champions League. But he'd had two seasons at Bologna before that, and he's not very good.
Something like
but
three goals looking. In 3 years, I think. Do you think?
Well, you say cite him wearing a headband as a positive, which Mark Knopfler used to wear a headband.
Mm. So did McEnroe.
Yeah, mm. Pat Cash. Mm.
Pat Cash, there we go.
A couple of other things in Serie A.
All right.
Steve Foster, yeah. Brighton legend.
Okay.
Atalanta obviously started the season with a six-point penalty.
Yep.
If they hadn't got that, they would be top of Serie A right now. They have 10 points, and they basically celebrate everything in homage to their captain, who's been banned for 3.5 years for match fixing. And then there was another thing.
Yeah, match fixing, which is also the reason for the six-point penalty.
Exactly.
Yep.
And
what's the story? Are they good at football, or are they just better at fixing? What's happening there?
Well, Atalanta are the so-called queen of the provinces. They have the best academy in Serie A, which has recently produced players like Pazzini and Montolivo. They've got 24 Italians in the squad, but it's these Argentines in their team which are really making a difference at the moment. Maxi Morales is one of the hottest young players in Serie A at the moment, signed from Vélez.
Hot like Osvaldo, or just a good player?
No, he's kind of small.
Right, okay.
And Germain Denis as well, El Tanque, has actually started scoring, which he never looked like doing before. So that's a great story in itself. But then there are 3-0 in Serie A this weekend.
Oh.
But one was between Lazio and Palermo. It's only remarkable because the Lazio Curva Nord started making monkey chants and booing at the Palermo midfielder, Friacqua. And the rest of the Olimpico whistled and shouted them down to tell them to shut up, as though to sort of police racism from within, which I guess...
It's quite a novelty for the crowd at the Olimpico, no? Excellent. Well, that's Soraway Serie A. A little bit of news from Ligue 1, where we've had the first Englishman scoring a goal in the French top division since Chris Waddle. How about that? Who was it, Barry?
Tony Cascarino?
No! Joe Cole and his little shorts. Have you seen Joe and his little shorts?
I've heard about his little
pants.
Yeah.
They're not that hot, to be honest. But everybody else in the team is wearing kind of fashionable knee-length Bermuda-style affairs, and he's there in kind of 1970 pants people numbers.
Is it possible? I thought this was... Is this legal?
Have I just revealed my age? Sorry.
That's an ask the ref question, isn't it?
What?
For the observer. I mean, the fact that, you know, a player shows up with shorter shorts than the rest of the team, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But anyway, it was a good goal.
Did you see his sort of induction at Lille where he had to sing?
I did. Yep.
Is it because I'm a Londoner?
Maybe it's because. You're revealing your age now.
Yeah. And then he ate some very strong cheese, which he likened to cheddar.
Right, okay, which is a strong cheese.
Can be.
Yeah, this foreign cheese business, nothing complicated there.
He's done really well there. I mean, Rudy Garcia, the coach, said it was an international goal, as though to say, come on, Capello, pick him, because... his debut against Saint-Étienne created a goal, and I think he's started three games in the last eight days.
Right.
So he's doing really well.
What position, if I can ask you a technical question, what position is he playing?
On the weekend, over the weekend, he was playing behind the striker.
Okay.
And he's been particularly linking up well with their best player, Eden Hazard. So. Top stuff.
There you go. Javier Pastore, another big name acquisition over the summer in France, scoring twice for Paris Saint-Germain in their 3-0 win over Montpellier. There you go. Lille, by the way, they only managed to draw. They keep drawing.
Last minute goal, 93rd minute.
There you go. That's it for part two. Coming up very shortly, exciting Brazilian news from Fernando and more from the Premier League. Part three, everyone, and over on our breaking news ticker desk to Fernando Duarte. Fernando.
Well, James, basically there's a bit of confusion in regards to the World Cup in Brazil in 2014. Needless to say, there's been a problem with, like, stadium construction delayed. But the biggest kerfuffle is the fact that the government took ages to pass the amount of laws the FIFA demands to actually host the World Cup. Basically, FIFA wants control of a lot of stuff. As you know, we might remember during South Africa, there were actually the police around the whole legal system.
Mm.
The law has been signed, but apparently FIFA are not happy with some of the terms. I mean, they agreed with something and the Brazilian parliament passed something different. And there are talks that FIFA might use a clause that allows them to pull out.
What's the thing that they're not agreeing on? Is it to do with wearing orange dresses or is it something less serious?
It's things relating to... To work conditions and including to money and to ambush marketing actions. They want a lot of control, which the Brazilian authorities are not very keen of giving to them. And there's talk about they using a special clause in which they could even pull out the World Cup without Brazil. They have until July next year to do it without having to pay.
Wow. Yeah. Until July next year.
Yeah, they can do it until July next year without having to pay. Two years before,
as you say. Yeah. And where would they go at that point?
I don't know. They probably come here because the thing we're saying Brazil is that the English criticize the World Cup because they want to get it. But you know, I'm just joking. I don't know. They certainly could do
it. Is that what you're saying, Brazil?
Well, some people say, England always criticizing because they want us to fail so they can get the World Cup because they can't win it on fair and square. But I know this is ludicrous.
Right. They can't win it fair and square the way that Brazil won it, with Ricardo Teixeira doing some really good...
What they meant is that England competing within the European nations. I was never...
We got João Havelange's son-in-law on our...
Let me say, you can access every past recording of this pod. I was never really proud of the way the World Cup was awarded to Brazil.
Okay.
I mean, there wasn't a dispute. Was a South American affair, and nobody in South America would dare competing against Brazil, and obviously against Teixeira. But on the other hand, the World Cup is not supposed to be a little club for the European nations. And if there is a nation outside Europe that has all the rights to try to host a World Cup, it's Brazil.
All right, then. It's all kicking off here. I'm going to back down now because Fernando's
I mean, I'm all right. And I think that the criticism is fair and square.
Yeah.
The government and the Brazilian FA, or the organizing committee, they are having problems.
So is this just a colossal bluff by colossal Sepp Blatter, or do you think there's actually a real risk of them doing that?
The risk is there, but... I think it's like this very drastic less resort thing. Because they are building things up. Even though the Maracanã conclusion deadline has been postponed until February 2013, it's still time for the Confederations Cup. I don't doubt that the sports infrastructure will be ready. The biggest problem is that all the work necessary to actually create the experience, or actually to facilitate people arriving and going around, especially for the areas, you know, the smaller places like Cuiabá in the center of the country. These works are very, very, very behind, especially at the airports. So there is a risk that the World Cup would be below par in a certain way. You know, we're a substandard World Cup. I don't really believe FIFA would do that, would take it away, because that would be also a massive... Whoever's in the command of FIFA... Mm-hmm. I think now is it going to be Blatter anyway. So I'm just going to rephrase that. Blatter would basically shoot himself in the foot pretty badly if he takes the World Cup away.
That sounds terrible, Fernando. Fingers crossed, eh?
Yeah, I think the country has to deserve this World Cup. Right.
Brazil is booming, and your league is booming, and players are coming back. Everything else is rosy about Brazilian football.
Yeah, but a lot of the World Cup project, he relies on public money and relies on the state, you know, taking some decisions. I mean, at several points, at national, state, and city level. So there's always a way that things can go wrong. And the Brazilian bureaucracy is really, really known for being late and for not taking things seriously until the last minute.
All right, interesting. Also on the Brazilian front, Zico appointed team manager at Iraq.
Yeah, he wants to work. He doesn't want to be in Rio de Janeiro just managing the youth academy he's got there. He never hit his will to actually try to do something. I mean, he won the Asian Cup of Japan once, but then after the 2006 World Cup, it all went sour. Did a half-decent job at Fenerbahce, also at CSKA. The thing is, Zico wants to prove himself as a manager. He also had a stint as a football director in Flamengo that ended really badly, to the point where he's actually not supporting the club anymore. You know, in a way, he's really like crossed with the actual board. Iraq job, I think, is also for financial reasons. I mean, remember that players like him did not make the amount of money that some guys do now. And he's got a family. He's got like a business to put some money in. So it's an interesting challenge. He's not going to be in Iraq, by the way, you know. He's going to live in Jordan, like most of the people involved with the serious business in Iraq. They don't live in Baghdad and vicinities. And they actually go to Amman. So let's see. But I think he started badly as well. I think that they lost the first game. Should be interesting to see, because the Arab countries have been places where Brazilian managers did well. Zagallo, Scolari, Pereira there with the United Arab Emirates in the 1990 World Cup, and Saudi Arabia as well in 1994. So we shall see.
How is Socrates' health these days? He was supposed to be at death's door recently, and just liver problems from drinking too much.
Yeah, he's got cirrhosis. Is that it?
Yes,
yeah, he's got still in the early stages, and he confessed to be an alcoholic, as if people didn't know. The thing with Socrates is that such an intelligent guy, who is a doctor actually, you know, he's a medicine man, you know, drunk himself into stupor all the time. But he's a fantastic guy to talk about these things. I remember sitting with him in a pub in Leeds once when he once played for Gaffertown as a kind of gimmick.
That was extraordinary. Though.
Yeah, that was extraordinary. And the amount of beer he used to have in his body was extraordinary as well. Right. There's a picture of us in that bar that is literally picking me up so I can stand to take the picture with him. He was bad. Some people were even joking in Brazil that him, George Best, were gonna do a fantastic partnership in the Heaven team. But he pulled back. Then he went back to hospital. His status is stable, but I think he needs a liver transplant, and people are actually trying to see how he's going to do. He needs to sort himself out, because otherwise he is going to be like Bessie, who had a new liver and destroyed it as well. But it's shameful. Shameful because he's a fantastic guy who still had so much to give to Brazilian football as a thinker and as a guy to actually point a finger to the wrong stuff happening there.
Yeah. All right, Fernando, fingers crossed there as well. We'll just finish off today with a little bit of a mention for a couple of clubs doing well this weekend. One of them, Newcastle, are regularly written off as a disaster waiting to happen. When they fired Chris Hughton, when they brought in Alan Pardew, when they sold the big fella, when they didn't sign another big fella.
And they sold the little fella.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. And yet there they are, top four. Anybody know why?
It's quite amazing, because their defence has been really good this year, even though it's got, what, Coloccini, Stephen Taylor, Ryan Taylor, Simpson and Krull. And then also their transfer policy has been quite high risk, high reward. They've signed players who have had issues with their medicals, Demba Ba being an example.
Mm, a ticking time bomb, Tony Pulis called him.
Yeah.
He might not have said ticking, he might have just said he's a time bomb.
Again, like him, Marvo as well, midfielder, medical at Liverpool. They signed Santon, who's obviously had lots of knee injuries at Inter Milan, but you know, has a lot of promise.
Mm-hmm.
And Ben Arfa, who had personal problems at Marseille, Hatem Ben Arfa.
Ask Alan Shearer.
Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Right. The thing is, Alan Pardew managed to open his big mouth again with comments like, you know, he blamed Demba Ba's drought on Ramadan. So he managed to basically offend the whole Muslim community.
Was that offensive?
I think it is. If you say, you know, he wasn't scoring because of Ramadan.
Well, because he wasn't eating during the day.
Yeah, but, you know, you got to be sensitive about this. It's like saying, well, he's missing the goal because, you know.
He's also wrong, because I read an article on this very subject in which, I can't remember where it's from, possibly Sports Illustrated or somewhere, but athletes who fast during Ramadan have been scientifically proven to perform a couple of percent better.
Well, remember
usual.
Hakim Olajuwon playing for the Houston Rockets, a great basketball player. He used to score like 40 plus points during Ramadan. Some people were actually joking that some other players should convert to Islam.
Right, but so, that's not offensive, is it?
I'm not saying it's not offensive. I'm just saying that, you know, you guys should know better, especially in this country where people take everything into, blow everything out of proportion.
Well, I think that's what you're doing, Fernando.
Literally.
Yeah, literally.
Literally, yeah. All right, then, how is Santon doing?
I think he had a bit of an injury scare.
Oh.
But he was back in the squad. I don't know if he has been playing.
All right, okay. Barr has been playing. He scored a hat-trick in their win over Blackburn Rovers. Johan Cabay?
Very good. One of the best midfielders in France last year. Won the double with Lille. Mm. Very good player.
I mean, him and Chiota in midfield for Newcastle, that's a very formidable pairing. He's been a great signing. Both great signings.
There you go, Magpies. And enfin, those crazy Spurs. They're not in the top four, but they're going to be in the top three. Didn't Harry Redknapp announce this? Informed the rest of us this weekend that Spurs are now top three side.
I missed that.
Yeah.
Adebayor played with one eye.
Yes. Literally.
He sustained an injury to his eye in the first half, was it? And then just played blind.
That's amazing, isn't it? He didn't score, but he did play well.
Yeah, he set up Van der Vaart's goal for the first for Spurs' first, and was just given another dimension to their play, really.
Excellent. And Van der Vaart back from injury. They have Arsenal next weekend, which they've done well in that fixture of late after a very barren spell. And before that, though, Barry, you know who they face in Europe, Spurs?
Shamrock Rovers.
Correctamundo. Tell us a little bit more about Shamrock Rovers.
Well, they're a team from Dublin based in Talla, having spent the best part of 20 years homeless, wandering around like nomads, squatting in other teams' grounds. I used to go and watch them in Talca Park when I lived near the stadium before I came over here 12 years ago. A lot of clubs.
Are you a Shamrock Rovers fan then?
I am, yes.
All right.
So,
will you be going to this game?
I am.
Ah, excellent.
I was supposed to be working at it, but circumstance and my desire to, rather than work, hook up with a few mates who are coming over and have a couple of pints is
right.
taking over. So, I shall be at White Hart Lane. Looking forward to it immensely. Rohan Ricketts, actually, former Spurs player. He's now playing for Rovers and scored his first goal for them at the weekend. And a lot of clubs don't take the Europa League that seriously, but it's a huge deal for A, Irish football in general, and B, Shamrock Rovers in particular, to be in this competition. They nearly went out of existence some years ago just through financial mismanagement, and they were relegated and had to sell all their players, get in cheapo players and short-term contracts, and they're doing really well.
Excellent. And given the fact that Harry Redknapp regards the Europa League as a nuisance, they might not be facing a full-strength Tottenham outfit.
It's possible. I mean, even a sub or a below strength Tottenham outfit should comfortably beat Rovers, but you never know. Rovers lost their first group game 3-0 at home, I think, to Dynamo Kiev, was it?
I think it was Rubin.
Rubin Kazan, yes.
Man from Blizzard with the answer.
Yeah. It's Partizan Belgrade, you know. They have giant killing potential.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's possible they could beat Spurs. I'd say it'd be more likely they beat Spurs in their little 6,000-seater stadium in Talla.
Oh, best of luck to all concerned. There is a busy midweek of action ahead of us, which we'll be reviewing on Thursday. Thank you so much, Barry, for your participation today. James, thanks very much for coming in. And you, Fernando Duarte, lovely to see you.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Excellent stuff. Thanks.
Literally.
Lisa, Ben. We'll see you on Thursday, and I hope you have a terrific week till then.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.